This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Ed Delamore. How are you, Ed?
Mate, so good. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, cool. You've just released a book. Well, not quite released.
We're on the cusp, mate. 23rd of June it comes out, so just a couple of weeks off. So very exciting.
Okay, I might even try and get it out, the show out for around the 23rd of June. But the book's called...
Mate, it's The Vineyards of Britain, Cellar Door Adventures with the Best of Britain's Wines.
Cellar Door Adventures with the Best of Britain Wines. Okay, and it's coming out very shortly, so by the time this is out, it'll probably be out. Where can you get the book?
All over. So 59vines.com is your best bet. It'll be in Waterstones, all major booksellers, and hopefully lots of independent bookshops too.
Okay.
Which is really important to us.
You got some distribution then, that sounds quite
good. Yeah, so very fortunate to, A, have the opportunity to do the project, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and B, work with a publisher, Fairlight Books, who are huge champions of... you know, high street independent bookstores. And ultimately, same as the approach of the book, it's all about local producers, local growers, supporting local, and having a good time, mate. And that's what wine's all about for me. So I was fortunate to embark on this project over all of last year.
Where's your accent from? Which part of England?
Well, Hertfordshire originally, yeah. But 10 years in Oz has, I think, potentially put a bit of a twang on it. But yeah. Now down in Bristol now, so a bit of an amalgamation of... yeah, a few places in different corners of the world, mate.
Okay, no problem. We'll talk about the book in a little bit, but before we get into that, just tell us a wee bit about yourself, your wine experience, etc.
Yeah, mate, so I've always been in wine. And for me, that started around the dinner table when I was very young. Mum and dad always loved their wine, always drunk it. Not necessarily the flashiest kit going, but it was always very much part of Sunday lunches, friends and family. And that's kind of a philosophy I've taken throughout my whole career and life, to be honest with you. So I left university in 2008.
What did you study?
I studied sociology at Leeds Uni, which is, and my mum's a social worker actually, and has been over 50 years. I was in about halfway through my final year at Leeds doing sociology, and she said, whatever you do, for God's sake, don't be a social worker. So I was like, yeah, cheers for the heads up on that one, mum.
Yeah, a bit late.
But I think, you know, back in the day, I was just massively about being outside and playing sport and good times and, you know, growing up and as I say, just having a load of good times and drinking a load of beers and being around people I respected and loved, you know, friends and family. I kind of got to that stage leaving university where I was like, I've dragged this out for as long as I could. Kind of need to get a job now. And I distinctly remember sitting in that university library, scrolling through a graduate job website, thinking, you know, what am I going to do? And this thing popped up and it said, graduate scheme, wine merchant. I thought, wow, that'd be interesting. And this was 2008, so wasn't the best time to be getting graduate jobs.
No.
And I thought, well, I'll do that for a year. I'll learn a bit about wine. That'll be interesting and forever relevant. And during the course of that year, the job market will settle down a bit and I'll work out what I want to do, you know, when I grow up, in inverted commas. And mate, 14 years later, I still haven't got a real job. You know, I still haven't really grown up. I think about 6 months into working in wine, I had that light bulb moment that, you know, many of us who work in the industry do. And I just realized this is me forever. And I was actually drawn to the wines of Australia, first and foremost. I worked in London for Majestic Wine Merchant, as seemingly half of the industry started their career.
Yeah, yeah.
Did all my WSETs with them. And as I say, for me, wine's all about enjoyment and good times with people. But I think if you can pick up little nuggets of info along the way, certainly it's very important if you're in the trade. But, you know, the most important person in wine is your everyday drinker, for want of a better phrase. I think if you can pick up just little nuggets of info, you can have so much a better time with wine.
Yeah.
And just further enjoyment, which is kind of why every wine's made. So I was in London, December 2010, tasted a 7-year-old Hunter Valley Semillon. They just blew me away.
Yeah, they're very Marmite wines. You either love them or you hate them.
And to that end, I took two bottles to a little Christmas dinner with a few mates that night, and I passed the first glass around, and no one wanted to even drink it after smelling it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, but I'm so into this wine. And I drank both bottles myself, and after that, I just wanted to drink another one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I ended up moving to Australia on the back of that wine, pretty much, and got a job with the winery that made it in the Hunter Valley.
Yeah, I like Hunter Valley Semillons, but they are...
they're not for everyone. But that's the beauty of wine. If everyone was the same, we all thought the same thing, it'd be really boring, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, and then a year out when I was working for this winery turned into the best part of 10. And that was all about a kind of desire to get amongst the vines and meet the people and drink and learn at source, which is really the best way to learn about wine.
What were you doing in the wines?
So working for small-scale producers in sales and events. So Mount Pleasant, very, very special place up in the Hunter Valley. And Yarra Yerring down in the Yarra as well. But fantastic time out in Oz, and I owe so much to many of the people I met and, you know, the wines I saw and the times I had kind of thing. And it was that sort of desire to discover at source actually what brought me back home to England, where I grew up, given that everything that's happened over here in the last 10 years, you know, so much has happened here. Mm. And it was really that kind of, as I say, desire to learn and discover And the single best way is with open bottles, with the people that make the wines, amongst the vines, with the people that grow the grapes. And so I got back at the end of 2020 and I thought, oh, you know, I'd done a bit of writing out in Oz, wrote a book in Oz and massively into my photography too. Sort of coming out of the pandemic, end of 2020, and moving hemispheres. So I was like, well, there's an opportunity here to really do what I want to do most of all. And for me, that's wine, photography, food, people, and writing. And I thought, well, I want to go and discover everything that's happening in the English and Welsh industry, because I've tasted two wines in my career total, and they were both sort of pre-2011. And you can probably guess which two they were, or which two producers they were. Knighttimber and Chapeldown.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is another very important part of our industry. And I read a couple of books on it, and I was sort of at a bit of a loss as to what's going on where still. And I thought, well, I want to go and discover it. Maybe loads of other people do too. And so I sort of embarked on this plan to travel around England and Wales for a whole year, visit 150 English and Welsh wine producers, taste 1,000 wines, and meet as many people as possible, photograph it and write about it. And as I say, very fortunate to sort of put that into a bit of an idea for the publisher, who loved the idea. And it sort of went from there, really.
Would have been during COVID, though, would it?
So back end, yeah. So I was very fortunate because I'm very much one to sort of get out there and get amongst it, to coin an Aussie phrase. And we were still in lockdown in Jan and Feb 2020. And that enabled me to sit down and really meticulously plan who I was going to see. Because for me, it's got to be about quality of juice. So I love some of the amazing wines we're making here, the approach of people, you know, they're sort of from an efficacy point of view. A lot of themselves see themselves as custodians of land, which is so, so important for us all. As is championing local, you know, local producers, local growers to a higher quality. These wines are traveling less miles, which is benefiting the environment, as are many of the methods that we're making, as opposed to, say, shipping in wine 10,000 miles from wonderful countries like Australia and New Zealand. That doesn't make any sense to me. And I think in 30 years' time, we'll look back on that and think, you know, what were we doing? If you're buying something from the local grower down the road, or if you're buying, it's a lot like eating good quality meat. We're all better off doing it less often to a higher standard and sourcing locally and putting money into local economies, rural economies, you know, and championing jobs and providing jobs for people who are very close to us. That makes perfect sense to me, I think. And so to have the opportunity to sort of fly that local flag. I think also many of us in the industry here have sort of put in thousands and thousands of professional hours into championing the amazing wines of those countries, you know, North American wines that I love, of Chilean wines. And now, given the quality of industry here, we've got the opportunity to do it for our own homegrown produce. And there's something really special about that.
Okay, well, tell us about the book. I think you described it as, well, you gave it a really pithy, quite quick, elevated description. Just tell us about the description of the book.
Mate, so the description of the book is, it's a guide to the wines of England and Wales, basically. Site, source, people, approach. It's sort of my take on what I think is looking good and how the wines are made. But it's also about what you can do at these places, which is a massively important part of it. So I think we have this opportunity here to break down that perception of a barrier to wine that a lot of people have growing up. And people have been to amazing vineyards in France and Italy, and there's always a bit of a cultural or language barrier, perhaps. And now you can go down the road and visit your local cellar door, and you'll discover that most of these people are actually just people like you and I who got into it because they love drinking wine. And they've fallen into either a growing or a making side of the industry. So it's very much about the people behind the wines as well, their histories. There's a bit of an intro into the history of wines over here and my kind of take and approach, which, as I say, is one all about enjoyment, first and foremost. And there's no sort of scores out of 100 or medals aren't really mentioned, because I just think wine's all about what it tastes to you, especially. Mm. So, and then it goes into chapters by region, basically. So there's 148 producers in the book. Each one of those is a little article on them, basically. The people, what they were doing before, why they're doing it. There's something interesting about every single one of those producers.
Yeah.
And most importantly, there's a bit of a review on all the wines that they make. So it's kind of me sort of pointing people in the right direction, going, hey, this is what I think. If you're in Devon next week, you should go and check out Alder. On the way back, you should go and see Langham at Dorset. If you're in, you know, Yorkshire next week, you should go up to Doonswood. This is what I think. Get out there, taste it, and enjoy it.
Yep. It's certainly not a book recommending wines, though. You know, you do mention certain wines.
Well, it kind of does, but it's not saying this is the best and this is 98 points and this is no good and this is 80. That doesn't mean anything to anyone if you haven't got the wine in front of you, right? And generally, if you're reading, it's more about a bit of an inspiration to either go and visit, or either, you know, go and buy, or either go and sample at you know, something like a trade fair, if you're in the trade like we are today. So, but it's my take on them. And I think most importantly, as good as having a great time at the Cellar Door is as good as great pizzas are in a barn on a beautiful setting, as good as the people and their approaches, the bottom line, it always has to come back to quality of juice, because that's why we're in it. And without that, there's actually no future industry. And that was the problem in the 80s and 90s. Some amazing sites planted by chance and amateurs making the wine. Whereas now there's been this huge shift to professionalism. And what do you know? Make some great wines. And discovering new wines is one of my sort of favourite things about wine. And that's what drives the excitement. And that's why, you know, wine can never get old. It's because there's always new, exciting stuff to discover. So it's me sort of pointing people in the right direction, hopefully.
I had a flick through the book. Your publisher sent me a copy of it before release, and I had a bit of a flick through it. And I was mainly I read the intro, and I went through a lot of the wineries I know reasonably well, just to get a feel for it, and a few that I don't really know anything about. And there's weird stuff in there that I was quite surprised by. I mean, I consider myself, I wouldn't say I'm a technical person from a winemaker's point of view, but I pride myself on sort of trying to keep up with trends and techniques and stuff. And there was a winery that you mentioned that had its frost protection was using wires.
Yeah, yeah.
Heated wires. And I was like, well, I've never
Winding Wood, Hungerford. Yeah, it's bonkers. And the scale of our injury here is so relatively small. So that's a little 3-acre site near Hungerford. It's beautiful. Drive up the drive. Block of Pinot on the right, block of Chardy on the left, and you think, well, I could be in Burgundy here. But because it's so small, only 3 acres, they can, you know, seriously hand-make the wines. A guy called Daniel Ham makes their wines. And relatively price point, the value is absolutely outstanding, but they can do things like, you know, heat all of the vines when the alarm goes off, when it drops to a certain temperature.
And frost.
You know, frost is such a devastating effect. There's probably our biggest threat here. So I think you know, a common thought about the industry here is, oh, it's getting warmer, right? You know, climate's changed. We can now ripen all these great grapes and we make great booze. That's all there is to it. Far from it. Yes, it is getting warmer. Yes, this is a crisis we're in, which is we're actually sort of presenting ourselves with so many more challenges. So milder winters leads to earlier onset of fruit. Spring frosts get more dramatic and later, to name but one. And so frost is every producer's nightmare and extremely expensive to prevent against.
Yep.
And with bougies, the candles that often line the vines, they're not only incredibly expensive, they're also not particularly environmentally friendly.
It's quite
sort of ironically.
Yeah.
So, you know, Christopher's approach down there is, you know, it's a lot of money to put in, but potentially, you know, to save him, instead of losing 3 crops every decade, he might kind of keep 9 crops a decade, which in the long run is more cost effective. But wine's such a long-term approach, and these people who are so passionate about it. And we're in the position here in England and Wales too, where we're not sort of bound by centuries of legislation or generational tradition, as you are classically in France, where a lot of the producers are handed down often through the sort of paternal side of the family.
Yeah.
And you do things because your dad did, because his dad did, because his dad did. David, who makes some great wines down at Nytor near St. Austell, he worked in Chinon. And they pick grapes then when the chestnuts drop. And I was like, well, surely you do it when there's a nice sort of balance between ripeness and acidity and, you know, there's not rain coming in or whatever. He's like, no, that's just how they've done it here for centuries. So that's how we do it. Whereas in England and Wales, we're sort of free to experiment. And that moves as we need to because it's such a young industry relatively. But that enables us to trial so many different things and we move forward quicker. And that's one of the reasons why so much has happened in the last 10 years. And actually the most exciting thing is what happens in the next 10 years and then potentially the 10 after that. You know, I was in London. Absolutely poor choice of decision making here, but in London on Thursday for the Jubilee, absolute chaos.
Yeah.
And I stumbled across the Night Timber bus, you know, and there's Night Timber parked up in the middle of an absolutely rammed Mayfair championing English wine. How good's that for the rest of the industry, you know? And I think a bit like champagne and the grower champagnes, which if you're in the industry, you're sort of really into a bit more than the Grand Marks, arguably, because I think the Grand Marks have often become a sort of case of wine marketing rather than making, largely due to scale. If you're making tens of millions of bottles,
yeah.
You know, you need to shift them, right?
Yeah.
That's much the same over here. You know, Night Timber and Chapeldown make some fantastic wines, and many people's first experience with English wine, as mine was, will be with Night Timber or Chapeldown because they're making the most. And they're making great wines, and that's so important because having had that first good experience, we will then move off to discover, you know, lots of other smaller scale, you know, more interesting backstories, shall we say.
You've been around, you've visited a load of different wineries. The book itself, as you said, it's quite nicely laid out. And I think it is somewhere between an opportunity if someone was going to do a bit of a wine tour or just as a coffee table book, because you've done an excellent job with some of the photographs.
Thank you. That's kind of you to say. Well, I'm hugely passionate about photography, much like wine, actually. I've always been into it for fun. I didn't get into either to make money, which is a fortunate thing, obviously. As those who work in the wine industry would know, it's all about passion. That, for me, is photography. And so to be able to combine these passions and writing too, I feel very, very fortunate, and also to share the stories. But yeah, you're exactly right, mate. The book is... it's kind of part coffee table book. It's kind of part guidebook. There's no sort of scores out of 100 or top 10s or logos or any of that nonsense. It's part kind of, you know, if you're going down to the southeast, the southwest, the north, Wales, here is where what I think you should check out. It's also, if you're sitting on the sofa of a hungover Sunday in Bethnal Green in December, have a flick through and decide what wines you want to buy for Christmas, you know? So I think that's really important to cover all of those things.
You said you tasted 1,000 wines.
Yeah.
You must taste a lot of fizz, but what other, apart from fizz, what really got you?
Mate, well, I think I'm immune to acidity now, actually. Having got back from Oz and then hitting 1,000 wine English tasting year, I don't taste acidity anymore, I don't think. But look, we're about 2/3 sparkling production in the UK, right? And that's where we've hung our hat, and that's why some of my Aussie winemakers, mates in Oz, are like, you know, stop taking the mick at me now. And are actually really interested in what we're doing, which I think is a, if you're getting sort of interest from the Aussies in your English, I think that says a lot. But, you know, I think there's so many traditional method, great, great traditional method wines being produced, and that will kind of always be our forefront. But like any wine region, some of the most exciting things are actually stuff you sort of stumble on behind the main. Yeah. Mate, I love sparkling. I've always been huge into champagne, and I love many of the wines of champagne. I used to work with Champagne Tattinger, and it's great to see Clovis here this week. So I'm very much, first and foremost, a sparkling wine lover. But even within the sparkling category, there's so much variation. Tommy Dunn at Langham is making a fantastic Col Fondo called Zigzag, which is just a really super fun, lively, energetic, great, accessible wine that, you know, goes into keg at the moment, actually, which you can get on tap in some places and have a wine with your mates. And I guarantee everyone in there will love it because it's so approachable. You know, some fantastic pet nuts being made to that end too. Charmat's a really interesting area that the industry is sort of exploring at the moment, and a lot of the traditional method producers are a bit wary of it. With some of the Germanic grapes that we've got in the ground historically, because they were planted in the sort of 70s and 80s because, you know, the disease resistance was a factor, you know, the good cropping, because basically if it's a hobbyist industry then, so if you're making wine for fun, it's no good if you ain't got no crop to make it with, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But some of these varieties make fantastic Charmat wines because they're so sort of aromatic and approachable. And that's a style that can actually get a load of people into drinking sparkling wine in the first place. Much like, it frustrates me in the industry actually when...
Just for the listeners, because Charmat is a word a lot of people use. You're just talking about Prosecco method, aren't you? Really?
Exactly, yeah. Tank method's sparkling. So the secondary fermentation takes place in a big tank as opposed to that individual bottle, as in traditional, aka the champagne method. Hence why it's much cheaper to produce.
Yeah.
Which makes it hopefully a more accessible price point, as long as not too many people are trying to cash in on it, which I think is the fear from traditional method. Because if you're, you know, an average punter walking down the street and you go into a wine shop and there's, you know, a traditional method sparkling package up on the shelf and a Charmat, how are you supposed to, and why should you know what the difference is? So that's a really important and interesting area moving forward. But as I was about to say, it frustrates me in the industry sometimes when people criticize Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, to use one example. Because that kind of style of wine actually gets so many people into drinking wine in the first place that will then go off and have this whole lifetime of discovery. And Charmat can do that for sparkling. And you can start drinking Charmat, or, you know, I love Charmat, to be honest. Now, as long as the wine's in balance, well-made, approachable, and all these key things. So even within sparkling, there's this huge variety, which is super exciting. But then beyond that, there is some bonkers stuff going on. Again, because we're not bound by sort of legislation or generational tradition. Anchor Hill make some fantastic fun wines. You know, they've got a Albarino that's 40 days on skins.
Yeah, orange.
You know, the orange wine. Brilliant wine. Is it in sync? Is it in balance? Is there a nice blend between, you know, acidity and fruit? Yeah, absolutely. It ticks all of those boxes. So don't look at just because it's natural or just because it's orange or just because it's Charmat and not classic. Don't judge it. Just go out and taste and see what you think, because they'll be guaranteed, like with any category of wine, there'll be good and bad versions.
Yeah, yeah.
So just, and if you think you don't like it, just keep tasting, because the chances are you just haven't had a good version of it yet, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, mate, really excited by so many of the amazing wines that have been made all over the country. I love the wines that Heppington are making down near Canterbury. Again, very accessible price point. yeah, making a fantastic gris, a really great Pinot Noir that's great after 20 minutes in the fridge. And that's an area due to, a lack of warmth in winemaking terms. We sometimes struggle for ripeness, certainly in vintages like last year, which was really cold and wet. So we're not in our lifetimes going to be making huge full-bodied reds.
No.
Sort of ironic though, we're in a great position to make really light chilled reds. I think that's a massively underrated category.
Yeah, it's true.
Ironic that we're in the great position to make those wines. Not necessarily the best climate to often drink them with.
No, but you look at the wines in the south of France, you know, they're making wines that they struggle to hold on to the acidity.
Yeah.
And they're making big gutsy wines. Well, they can make big gutsy wines fairly easily, but then they've got the climate for a light style of wine.
Absolutely, mate. But I think also there's exciting turns around every corner in this country. I was down in Lymington the other week with Tim Phillips at Charlie Herring, which is a producer, a person, some wines that everyone who's into wine needs to try and get their hands on. I mean, this is much easier than said than done because he's just got a 1-acre walled garden vineyard in Lymington. I think it was cycling past one day and it saw a sign saying walled garden vineyard for sale. But the wall traps in the heat and the warmth.
Is this down in
Lymington?
New Forest?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, mate. Yeah,
I went and had a visit.
Fascinating dudes. And he'll, you know, go down there on his annual open day and he'll talk to anyone. The beauty of winemakers here too. They're very relatable people.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got some Riesling in the ground, which is bonkers from a very cool climate. Riesling being so late ripening and traditionally so acidic. You think, well, that'll never work in England. And this is a great thing I relearn every time I go somewhere new in England and Wales is never generalize, never write anything off. Just keep going, keep tasting.
I was just interviewing someone earlier and he seemed to think Welsh Rondo. Did that come up at all?
Mate, Rondo's a really funny one because that's another traditional varietal that makes a great kind of light, very bright, very approachable style.
Yeah.
And a lot of times with grapes, I mean, to use Chardonnay as a classic example, a reputation can kind of precede itself. Now we're in the stage with Chardy where so many people, you know, the bad reputation of Chardonnay was sort of 80s, 90s.
Yeah, yeah. Blamed on the Australians, I might add.
Well, maybe the methods rather than the Aussies themselves, but that gave shot and a bit like Riesling in England. So, you know, Blue Nun ruined the reputation of Riesling in England for so long. Yeah, yeah. But now more people get into wine from a younger age and don't really care about that. They just want to taste it and say, well, what's the story behind it? So yeah, I think, I love what Tim's doing that down there. And, you know, his Riesling massively works. He was putting it in a Solera style sparkling, which is a kind of system of fractional blending ultimately because so much acidity needs time to dissipate.
Yeah.
And this is a kind of a big issue of a lot of sparkling wine producers. We're seeing really long lees aged sparkling wines, which develops flavour, but crucially softens that acidity. All Angels in Berkshire have just released a long lees aged 2014. It's looking sensational.
So 2014, so 8 years.
Yeah, so but they released it a couple of years ago and they kept some back and they've just released it recently and they've got more held back to retaste next year. Dosage accordingly and release down the track, which is...
A bit like Mount Pleasant do with their Elizabeth wines.
Yeah, Elizabeth and Lovedale. Yeah,
throw it back to the old Simeon and Hunter Valley.
The time is such an important factor with wine and can make such a massive difference, even to like relatively, you know, cheap wines, to be honest. As long as it, you know, good fruit, good quality, well-made, especially those new world wines that, you know, need time to kind of soften out that ripeness. Acidity, you know, if you taste the wine that's too young, the acidity can, you know, take your gums off, take your teeth out, basically. So yeah, time is crucial, but what, you know, that means it's very expensive to sit on what is effectively cash tied up in stock.
Yeah, yeah.
But you need to for the best quality of the wine. Black Chalk are one of my favorite producers in Hampshire. Hampshire's a fantastic region for Chardonnay, especially. We hear a lot about the sort of chalk that goes underneath Kent and Sussex and under the same band of chalk underneath Champagne and White Cliffs of Dover. And this is true, but there's much more going on geologically in the southeast than just a whole band of chalk, but it's quite a romantic sort of marketing tool.
Yeah.
We hear most about the southeast in terms of chalk because that's basically where our two biggest producers are and they've got the biggest marketing budgets, which helps everyone else because it puts money into the, you know, sort of promotion into the category. Some of the best chalk-laden Chardonnays coming out of Hampshire from the likes of, you know, Black Chalk, Rames, two great producers. Black Chalk only release their wines when they're absolutely ready to go.
They've only been going for about 3 or 4 years, though.
Yeah, so the vineyards were planted before, and Jacob and Zoe both sort of met at Hattingley, which is one of our biggest and best producers, and Emma, fantastic winemaker, Emma Rice, has just left there.
Oh, has she?
She has, yeah.
I just released a load of interviews with her about 2-3 months ago.
I just released a book with her in, mate, about, you know, yeah, all the great wine she makes. Hattley is like, Dermot's left Wisden, and yeah. You know, Dermot Sugar is such a cult, amazing winemaker, and he's left Wisden. I thought, but that's the beauty of wine, it's ever changing.
Yeah.
So hopefully, maybe opportunities to do another book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed there was some stuff that was out of date already.
Already, it's not even out yet.
Yeah.
But that's wine, right? And if it was the same forever, it'd be boring, I wouldn't do it. And so, yeah, I think I love telling the stories of places like Hampshire that maybe slightly smaller producers don't have the marketing budget, but will, you know, if there's, they might have some of their wines on a wine list in amazing restaurants, and these restaurants in town might be like, yeah, we need some more wines. Well, it's not ready yet, so we're not going to release it. I think this sort of sense of regionality is very much a reflection of where we're at in the industry now. So you see a lot of people talk about the Crouch Valley and amazing producers like Danbury Ridge. And in terms from a professionalism point of view, just point people in that direction and go and have a look where you can't actually go there because they're solely focused on producing high quality wine. And the Crouch gets so much great press, rightfully so. And, you know, producers like Newhall have been there for 50 years and been making great wines because it's so, you know, east of the country, warm and dry, amazing London clay underneath it, which is similar clay to what's underneath Pomerol. So this is the other generalization that you hear a lot. Oh, you can't plant in clay because vines don't like cold, wet feet.
It's cold.
No, it depends what's going on sort of underneath that sort of layer of clay. And if those vine roots are kept super dry and stressed and surge through this sort of layer further, some of the ripeness you can produce is quite outstanding. I think in 2018 in the Crouch, they recorded 14.7% ABV as a new record, which is frankly frightening.
Yeah, it's
but cool. I think this, you know, Crouch gets some amazing press and rightfully so. This sense of regionality, as I say, is very much a reflection of where we're at. I was fortunate to be in the Stoner Valley, South Oxfordshire, a couple of weeks ago, put some vines in the ground. And this is probably the region I'm most excited about, you know, South Oxfordshire, which is always just, sounds bonkers to me. But the sort of topography and geology in this particular part of the country of the world is perhaps as the most exciting of all, really. And there you've got some amazing producers like Stoner Valley Vineyard. You've got Wyfold Vineyard. And not too far away, Marlow, Harrow and Hope. And Henry Lathwaite's making the wines for both Harrow and Hope, his own site, and his mum Barbara's down the road at Wyfold. And if anyone wants to see the quality of English sparkling wine, I would just say, go and get a bottle of Harrow and Hope, go and get a bottle of Wyfold, you know, around about 30 quid price point. And I will hang my hat on the phrase that these wines will deliver more value for money than a champagne at twice the price.
Okay, mate. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Ed.
Yeah, nice, mate. Well, thanks for having me.
Not a problem. And so just so everybody knows, the book's called The Vineyards of Britain.
Cellar Door Adventures with the Best of Britain's Wines.
Excellent. And it'll be available at
59vines.com, all good bookshops and some rubbish ones, probably.
From the 23rd of
June.
Lovely. All right, mate. Thank you very much.
Thanks, mate.